All right, well, we'll go ahead and begin this week in our series on Job. We are coming near to the end of Job's friend's conversation with him, trying to instruct Job on what is going on in his life. Remember when we started this series of conversations, which has turned into a debate between Job and his three friends who have spoken so far, is that Job kind of asked the question, and he's like, I just don't understand what's going on in my life. This doesn't make sense, because all of this bad stuff that has happened to me ought not to be happening to me because I've not done anything wrong. I'm a perfectly upright person who loves God, so why am I being allowed to suffer? And so then Job's friends answer his question by saying, well, of course, Job, it doesn't make sense to you, but it makes sense to us because God only causes suffering on those who are wicked. If you'll notice the questions up here on the screen that have been up every week, is the question is suffering a punishment? Job's three friends seem to believe that suffering, bad things, destruction, turmoil, trials in your life, is simply a form of divine punishment. I hope so far we've seen that that is not a complete rounded out picture of what suffering is. That yes, although sometimes God uses it to correct or to discipline people who belong to him, or also he brings suffering upon those who are wicked, that simply because someone is suffering does not mean that they're under some form of divine punishment. It can be the case, it sometimes is the case, even in our own hearts, in our own lives, that God is causing suffering as some form of corrective action on something that has happened with us in our hearts. And then another question is, do I deserve this? Is this something that I caused because I did something wrong? Am I guilty of sinning, and that is why I am suffering? That's kind of the question that Job asks and then answers quickly to his friends and says, no, I've done nothing to deserve this kind of punishment. So all of the characters so far in this conversation have viewed suffering as a form of divine punishment on mankind. And that is the only thing in their entire belief system that makes sense, is that suffering comes either as corrective for those who believe in God or as punishment or judgment on those who do not believe in God. That is why you suffer. Last week, we saw that suffering ought to actually draw us closer to God, that in fact, when we suffer, we should be drawn closer to God. Although Job is struggling, he has gone from a place of no hope to some sort of hope, even if it might be a misguided understanding of himself and the situation, is that suffering sometimes is brought to us because of punishment, but also, regardless of the reason that the suffering has happened, suffering can cause us to grow closer to God. And the central question in the book of Job is this: is God just? Is God a just God? Is he righteous? Does he orchestrate the universe correctly? All of Job's friends dogmatically will say yes. And that is why suffering as a form of punishment is only brought on those who have done something wrong, Job. But Job is really kind of asking the question, well, is God doing things right? Because it seems to Job that since punishment of suffering should only come on those who have sinned, and Job thinks that he has not sinned, and in fact God told us in the beginning that he hadn't sinned, that's not why this happened, that then God must be breaking his own rules. So those three questions come from this diagram that I'll throw up here again. The three central issues in the book of Job is God's justice, Job's innocence, and the law of retribution. The characters in the book of Job believe that God runs the universe on the principle that if you do good things, you get good things. You do bad things, you get bad things. That is the principle, most high, universal, cosmic law. That if you do what is right, you get good things. If you do what's bad, you should suffer. This week, we're going to see a beginning to shift away from the conversation of justice and to open up a new topic this week. So let's jump into chapter 22. Eliphaz starts again. This is the third and final series of speeches. They get shorter and more angry. and more rude if you understand the tone that is being given here. So again, we're going to go through chapter 28 today and a little foreshadowing on a couple other chapters. So we're going to have a lot of ground to cover, so stay with me. Eliphaz in chapter 22, verses 1 through 3, he kind of asks Job, "So you think you're important to God?" He says this, "Can a man be of any use to God? Can even a wise man be of use to him? Does it delight the Almighty if you are righteous? Does he profit if you perfect your behavior?" Eliphaz says, "Okay, Job, so great. What if you are perfect? What does God get out of the deal? You think that you're so important that God needs you? What does he benefit from?" It's an interesting question, right? Because we also have these questions. Does God really need us? No. You guys could have shouted no. That's fine. No. He does not need us, and yet he still somehow wants us for a purpose. The question Eliphaz is asking is, he's kind of telling Job, you think too highly of yourself, that you think that you get to orchestrate the way that the universe works. Oddly enough, there is some wisdom in the questions that Eliphaz is asking here, even though, as what will follow will demonstrate, he did not ask this in a good, well-intentioned manner. He kind of just says, like, Job, you think you're so important? What's God get out of the equation? And he's kind of saying, like, well, Job, you know, obviously it's not your relationship with God is not working out because you're getting destroyed over here. So what's your problem? But it is an interesting question that will continue to be asked through the remainder of the book of Job. Is mankind, is Job important to God? Does God get something from Job? And does Job have the right to demand how the universe functions? Then he gets into verses 4 through 11, and he just straight up tells everybody Job did a whole bunch of bad stuff with absolutely no proof. Okay, so you can read those verses. I won't read those, but basically Eliphaz accuses Job of charging interest without cause to people who borrowed money from him so that then they became bankrupt and became enslaved. He also accuses Job of not having compassion on needy people even though he was plenty wealthy, that he was greedy and held on to all of his wealth and didn't help those who came to him and said, like, hey, I'm starving, can I have a little bit of your food? He also says that Job is being corrected and punished for not taking care of the helpless, such as widows and orphans. And we're like, oh, okay, where did that come from? Eliphaz just straight up says, look, here's the thing. You think you're so important to God? Then why'd you do all this bad stuff, Job? And we're looking at the stuff that Eliphaz is accusing him of, and there is no basis, apparently, as we'll see as another character enters the scene and kind of clarifies for us that these accusations are just off the wall. They are not based on any reality. It is based on the fact that because of the amount of punishment you are receiving, Job, you must have done this evil of a thing. You must have been terrible to everyone. You must not have used your wealth that God had given to you to help anyone. You, in fact, probably got rich through corrupt means. So then he proceeds to talk in verses 12 through 20, where yet some sort of another little interesting bit of actually decent wisdom in there. He says, isn't God as high as the heavens? And look at the highest stars, how lofty they are. And he says, look, Job, get some perspective. Look up, see how high the stars are, and know that God's above those. And then verse 13, he says, yet you say, what does God know? Can he judge through thick darkness? So he accuses Job of saying, like, yeah, actually, I've looked up and saw that God is so high above the earth that I think I can get away with all this stuff. How can God know what's going on in this world when he's above the stars and above all the darkness and looking down through all the clouds? Is he going to take notice of me? So I'm just going to get rich while I can at the expense of all those around me I'm called to help. And then, again, aside from the fact that he just accused Job of having a really terrible heart, he then says, clouds veil him so that, oh, this is what he accuses Job of saying, clouds veil him so he cannot see as he walks on the circle of the sky. And then he says, will you continue on that ancient path that wicked men have walked. They were snatched away before their time, and their foundations were washed by a river. And he continues to go and say, like, that's a terrible way to do life, Job. And we're all like, yes, that is a terrible way to do life, but why are you saying that Job's doing that? What is Eliphaz's big deal with the situation? Verses 21 through 30, he repeats a very similar thing as he said in the previous cycles, is that Job needs to humble himself so that he can be saved and to be restored. So, Eliphaz's wisdom has not really much changed in the book. He has brought up some very good points about who God is and the relationship between God and man. Yet he insists that God is just. God does punish those who do what is wrong through the cosmic law of retribution. Therefore, Job must be guilty. So if Job is guilty, he must repent to be saved, to be restored. And as we talked about a couple weeks ago, that is the case. If you have done what is wrong, God delights in rescuing you. He calls you to repent and to be saved, and then he would restore you to a right relationship with him. But Eliphaz has continually gotten more and more angry with Job, more and more pointed in the way he has addressed Job and accusing Job of being a terrible human being. Chapter 23 and 24, Job responds in similar fashion as he has. Let's look at verses 3 through 7. If only I knew how to find him, God, so that I could go to his throne, I would plead my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. He says, like, listen, if I could just walk into a room and find God, I'd go talk to him. The reason I'm talking to you is because I can't find God. So Job's kind of like, back off. Let me know. I would talk to God face to face, and I would fill my mouth with arguments. I would make my case. And then he says, I would learn how he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he prosecute me forcefully? No. He will certainly pay attention to me. Then an upright man could reason with him, and I would escape from my judge forever. So Job responds to Eliphaz's accusations, and he says, how can I find God? Like, do you know where he is? Because if I can find God, I will go to him. I will plead my case with him. And this is what Job's expectation is. Now, he had said this previously in the book, and he said that God wouldn't listen, that you wouldn't be able to change God's mind, that God would not care, because that is how he is feeling, because he's been crying out to God about all this unjust suffering on him, and nothing has changed. But now, at this point in the book, Job says, like, no, listen, okay, I get it. If I can find God, I would tell him what is going on. I would plead my case and say, I don't deserve this punishment. Why did you do this? And then he says this, I would listen to him and listen for his answer. He first says, I will plead my case and he would listen, and then I would understand how he responds to me. So Job is saying, like, I just need to have an open conversation with God about what has happened in my life, because basically, thanks. No thanks, Eliphaz. You've done me no good. We have gone through so many chapters of the book of Job and cycles of conversation, and yet we are still at the same point as at the beginning when Eliphaz says, like, suffering comes on those that are bad, Job, so repent and be restored. Nothing has changed. And so Job is getting more and more frustrated with his friends and also longing for the opportunity to actually have his case heard so that it could be understood and he would be able to understand what God is doing. And then he says, like, an upright man would be able to reason with God. And previous, Job said that no matter how good you are, you would never be able to reason with God because God does whatever he wants. So Job's heart has begun to change and begun to shift towards understanding that there is hope with God. And then verse 13 through 14, he says that, of course, God is unchangeable. Who could oppose him? He does what he desires. He will certainly accomplish what he has decreed for me, and he has many more things like these in mind. And Job says, so basically I want to talk to God so that he can listen to me and understand where I'm coming from, and then I'm going to listen to him. And then he says, a just man could reason with him, but then he says, doesn't mean that's going to change God at all, because God doesn't change. Therefore, verse 15, he says, I'm terrified in his presence when I consider this. I'm afraid of him. So he's like, I'm actually, like, really afraid of going before God and trying to reason with him because I know that I cannot change him. He's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to accomplish what he sets out to do. Whatever he decided is going to happen is going to happen. And yet Job is like, but I want to understand why it is that this isn't working according to how I understand him. And he says that God has made my heart faint, yet I am not destroyed by the darkness that covers my face. So Job here is bringing up some very realistic feelings about how it is that we live in a world with a God that we can maybe talk to, and yet we don't always get back responses. You know, up until this point, Job has prayed. In fact, he's talked to God throughout this book, and he has asked him things. But what Job is asking for is a face-to-face conversation with a personable God that can explain why and what he is doing so that Job can understand it, because he knows that God is not going to change his plan. For us today, like, this is what we do when we have to go through things that don't make sense to us. We also have to approach God and be able to voice our objections, to voice our concerns, and to voice what we think should happen in a situation. And yet we have to get to the same point that Job is, that regardless of what we think needs to happen or what God should have been doing or should do in response to what is taking place, God is going to do what he decrees. And we don't change God. But conversations with God will change us. This is what Job says, is I'm terrified in his presence when I consider this. I'm afraid of him. He's kind of beginning to say, like, I'm afraid to go talk to God because then it's going to change something about me. It's going to have to change something about my understanding, because God does not change. And if I don't understand God and I get to talk to him and he responds back to me and I understand, then I'm the one that changes. So then he says in chapter 24, he begins to ask a question that he has asked before. He comes to this understanding, but then he says, like, so one of the things I want to talk to God about is, why don't you actually destroy the wicked people quickly? Like, why don't you actually punish people who are evil? Because here I am, I'm not evil. I'm getting punished in Job's mind. And yet there are plenty of wicked people in the world that you haven't punished yet. And yet, yeah, sure, maybe they get their punishment in the end. But why is it taking so long? And why am I, you know, suffering what should be happening to the wicked? He leaves that question open-ended. And then in chapter 25, Bildad talks. And luckily, only for 6 verses. Bildad poses, again, the same question that Bildad or one of the other friends posed in the beginning series, which is, can any man be pure in front of God? Can anyone be found righteous before him? And then let's look at the end, verse 6, starting verse 5. He says, like, how can a person be justified before God? Anyone that is born of a woman be pure? If even the moon does not shine and the stars that are not pure in his sight. So the moon and the stars are not pure and perfect in God's eyes, Bildad is saying. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm? Again, there's somewhat of a halfway decent question there, which is, Job, you're declaring yourself to be righteous, and that God is punishing a righteous person, which doesn't fit with our understanding of God's justice. So how can it be that any person is righteous before God? Like, look at the stars, Job. He doesn't even think those are perfect. How much more does he look at you and see all of the flaws in who you are and what you've done and the wickedness of your heart, because you are like a maggot or a worm in God's eyes? Again, asking Job to get some perspective, and yet the perspective Bildad is asking Job to take is not one that is consistent with God's character either. Does anyone take issue with the fact that Bildad is saying that mankind is nothing but a maggot or a worm in God's eyes? Just me? Okay. Like, I get it. We sing that one song, Save a Wretch Like Me. There's, like, all these other songs out there. It talks about, like, how wicked of a person I am. There is an okay understanding to understand that we are like nothing when we are compared to God, and yet God does not look at humans like we look at maggots. God does not look at Job or any of Job's friends like they are worms. Although he would have every right to. In comparison, we are nothing but specks of dust that live for a vapor of time in God's world, and yet God does not look at people like we are worms, maggots, or insects. So Bildad tells Job, gain some perspective here, Job. Of course, God is going to punish you because in his eyes, you're nothing but a bug. And that is simply not the case. How do we know that is not the case? Because in the beginning, when God created the world, he made mankind in his image, both men and women made in the image of God. He made them to have dominion over all of the earth that he had created. He then had a relationship with them. He lovingly actually cared for them and wanted to have that walking relationship with them. When they broke the world, he decided a way that he could fix it on their behalf. And yes, although God would have every right to look down on people, God lifts people up because he made them to be his representatives, to be his image bearers in his world. God cares about people in a way that these men do not understand. God does not just look down on the earth and like, oh, look at this little thing trying to do something over here. He loves his creation, and he cares about it, and he knows what is going on. Nothing escapes his view. In chapter 26, Job responds, as well as chapter 27, and then we're going to get into a little bit of confusing structure of Job, so hang in with us. In chapter 26, let's just read verses 1 through 4. This is what Job says in response to Bildad. Wow, how have you helped the powerless and delivered the arm that is weak? How you have counseled the unwise and thoroughly explained the path to success. Who did you speak these words to? Whose breath came out of your mouth? In case I didn't read it sarcastically enough, Job is not actually saying to Bildad, hey, great point, bud. He's saying, yeah, thanks a lot. Super helpful. Job's like, what are you seeking to accomplish with these words? You have not helped me understand. You have not thoroughly explained to me what I am to do. You have not given me counsel. You have not strengthened me. You have not actually given me any wisdom that is able to be acted upon. And then verses 5 through 14, Job admits what Bildad is trying to say and yet gets a twisted view by the end of it. He says, yes, God is truly great. So Job finds the little bridge with Bildad and says, yes, I understand that God is much greater than I am, that he is far above the entire world, that no matter what happens, he is bigger and greater. And yet he poses this question throughout in these verses. Yes, God is truly great, but who can understand him? Who can know him, Bildad? Like, that's great. God is so much bigger than us. But how are we to know him? How are we to understand what he's doing? Remember that the events of the book of Job take place before the books of the Bible were written. That they were living in this ancient time period where what they believed about God was passed down orally, so it's not like they didn't understand the things that are in the Bible. Yet Job is saying, like, here we are, we're arguing about, is God just and run the universe on the law of retribution? But how are we supposed to know, guys? Where are we supposed to go look for the answers? Chapter 27, Job continues, and he begins to say in verse 2, as God lives. So as long as God's around, who has deprived me of justice and the Almighty, who has made me bitter, so he just wants to clarify in case we're confused about which God he's talking about. As long as my breath is still in me and the breath from God remains in my nostrils, my lips will not speak unjustly and my tongue will not utter deceit. And we're like, okay, good, right? We're all like, good job, Job. Like, you're not going to say bad stuff about God. Unfortunately, that's not really what he's talking about. In verse 5, he says, I will never affirm that you are right. I will maintain my integrity until I die. I will cling to my righteousness and never let it go. My conscience will not accuse me as long as I live. Job just sat through an entirely way too long section of the Bible of his friends saying truthful things twisted to become very unhelpful and to not help Job in his situation. And Job's conclusion is this: as long as God's alive and as long as God allows me to live, I'm not going to speak falsehood, but I will never admit that you are right. I will say with my whole heart, I am righteous. I will never be accused, even by my own conscience, as long as I live. Now, if Job is saying in this one situation, I'm not going to admit that I did anything wrong because I know that I didn't, that is definitely more understandable. As we continue to read through Job's discourse, it sounds as though Job is just saying, look, I know I'm right. I've not done what is wrong. Therefore, God has done what is wrong by not being just. He has deprived me of my justice, and he has made me bitter. And I will hold on to the fact that I am completely innocent as long as I live. This does not sound like the hopeful conclusion we would have Job come to. For Job to say, like, I know I'm completely innocent, and so I don't deserve anything that has happened to me, and so God must have been unjust. That is the temporary conclusion Job has come to. And his friends kind of helped him get there by giving him super unhelpful advice about God and how God sees him and how God punishes the wicked and does nothing else. And Job is saying, like, fine, if that's the case, if God runs the universe on the law of retribution and only punishes wicked people, he misused the law in this situation. He is guilty. Now, the confusion as far as structure goes is verses 13 through the end of 23. Is that Zophar talking? Because apparently Zophar doesn't talk again, or at least the narrator doesn't introduce him. So some people think that verses 13 through 23 are Zophar. Some people believe that that is continuing of Job's discourse. I would say it doesn't really matter who says it. It's still unhelpful. In this situation, is a continuing of the same themes that we have seen, that is what happens to wicked people. This destruction Job is facing, this is what happens to wicked people. So if Job has come to this conclusion, if this is Job talking, he's saying, this is only what's supposed to happen to wicked people. God doesn't know how to run the universe correctly. If it's Zophar, it would be pretty typical, because Zophar said pretty much the same thing before, which is, the way you feel is because you're wicked, Job. And so no matter what who is talking here, it doesn't really help solve the question that no matter what happens, either Job has become convinced that this is what happens to wicked people, I'm not a wicked person, therefore I don't deserve it, or Zophar saying you do deserve it because you are wicked, it is still unhelpful and incorrect theology that suffering only comes as a form of divine punishment to those people who are wicked. So then, chapter 28 then becomes a big question too. Who is talking in 28? Is Zophar? We're like, because if Zophar says all the stuff in chapter 28, apparently Zophar has figured out a whole lot of stuff about life, or is, again, just saying unhelpful things. Is it Job? You know, if he's continuing from chapter 27, is Job then come to this conclusion, which would seem very unlikely because of what he had just said in chapter 27, and then what he continues and picks up in chapter 29, that somehow Job has this moment of clarity in chapter 28 and then instantaneously loses it all and then goes back to defending himself as though he is the most righteous person on the face of the planet. I think it is best for us to understand that chapter 28, it's a poem, which is, you know, the case for most of the discourse in Job, but that chapter 28 is a poem about wisdom that is inserted either from the narrator's perspective or from an outside understanding, or possibly was put here by the author, or possibly was written by Job and inserted into this because it is the turning point of what is going to happen in this book. So let's talk about chapter 28 for a couple minutes. We read verses 1 through 12. It talks about how there is a place where you can mine both gold and silver and iron and copper, that miners go down under the earth, they swing off of ropes to do their work, they tunnel through the earth, they purify those tunnels and find metals by using fire and being able to do all these things. And then in verse 5, it says that food comes from the earth, but below the surface, earth is transformed as by fire, and then we get all of these things, and yet animals do not know it, they do not see it, they don't understand the paths that the miners have made, and we're all like, why are we talking about mining, right? Job was a farmer, not a miner, okay? Here's the poem, though, is that there is a place where you can find wisdom. You can mine it. You can find gold in the earth. You have to do a little bit of work, but you can find it. You can find the sources of streams. You can bring to light things that are hidden. But verse 12 begs the question, but where can wisdom be found? Where is understanding located? Because we cannot dig in the earth and find it. It's very similar to the question that Job asked, which is, where can I find God? Because I want to talk to him. This poem asks the question, where can you find wisdom? There's a place in the world where we can find silver, gold, iron, and copper. But where can you find wisdom? And the answer to the question is, well, you can't find it in the earth. Then the second answer is, and you can't buy it. In verses 13 through 19, it is said that no matter what you have, you cannot purchase wisdom because wisdom does not have the ability to be valued by the things that we can find in the earth. No matter the amount of gold, no matter the amount of precious stones, no matter the amount of silver, no matter how many articles of fine clothing or any of these other precious metals or diamonds or pearls, nothing can compare with the value of wisdom, and therefore you can't buy it. Not only can't you find it, even if you found it, you couldn't afford it. So then the question is, but then where does wisdom come from and where is understanding located? So how do we come to grips and get some understanding? How do we find wisdom in a life like Job's if we can't find it on the earth? And even if we found it, we wouldn't be able to afford it. Where do we get wisdom from? Where is understanding located? I believe that this poem is well placed here because Job had asked the question that, yes, God is surely great. Who can understand him? Who can know him? This poem answers the question, well, it's the same thing. You don't know where to find wisdom, and even if you found it, you couldn't afford it. But where do we find wisdom? It's hidden from the eyes, verse 21, of every living thing, concealed by from the birds of the sky. Even Abaddon and Death say, we have heard of it with our ears. So they're like, we kind of know it exists, but we don't have it. So no wisdom can be found in the land of the living, nor in the land of the dead. But God, verse 23, understands the way to wisdom, and he knows its locations. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When God fixed the weight of the wind and limited the water by measure, when he established a limit for the rain and a path for the lightning, he considered wisdom and evaluated it. He established it and examined it. He said to mankind, the fear of the Lord is this wisdom, and to turn from evil is understanding. Where do we find wisdom? Where do we go to get understanding? It's not to our earth. It's not to those around us. We cannot find it in the land of the living. And even if we found true wisdom, you wouldn't be able to purchase it with the things that you have. The only place where you can go to get wisdom, to get understanding, is to God himself. God understands the way to wisdom. He knows its locations. Why? Because it is by wisdom that he created the world. And we can ask the question, we're like, okay, so why in the world is this here in Job? Yes, Job is wisdom literature, obviously, because it's got a whole poem about wisdom, right? But like, if you are understanding what has just taken place, Job has asked the question, I don't understand what is going on in my life, and his three friends have just tried to answer it for the last 20-something chapters, and we've gotten the same answer from his friends as before, and Job has come to the conclusion that God must not run the universe correctly because he deprived me of justice by punishing me when I didn't deserve it. Chapter 28 comes in and says, you guys are all talking about the wrong thing. Now, I don't think that this was spoken in the narrative. I believe that this helps us understand the path that is going to change here slightly with Elihu and then more completely with God at the end of Job is this. Here, Job and all of his friends are talking about how justice is the foundational law of all of the things in the universe. This poem tells us that that is not the case. The foundational law of the universe is God's wisdom. Not God giving good things to good people and bad things to bad people. If that were the foundation of the foundational law of the universe, we could run the universe. It wouldn't be that hard, right? In fact, we have whole justice systems set up on this principle that if you do what is wrong, you should have some form of punishment that fits the crime. But if you didn't do anything wrong, you should be set free, right? And we all have this understanding of that's how justice works. But if that's all that is needed in order to run the universe, we could run the universe. But that is not what God designed this world to function off of, as this poem teaches us. God set the foundations of the earth. He put the weight of the wind, which we're all like, wait, you can weigh wind? No, that's the point. He limited the water, limited the rain, made a path for wisdom. He did it as he considered wisdom. He evaluated it, he established it, and he examined it. He said, this is how the world will work. It is by my wisdom. God did not establish this universe to function off of a strict code of do what is wrong, get punished, do what is right, get rewarded. Instead, he operates the world by his own wisdom. And the questions that Job and his friends are asking is not the right question. They are asking, is this fair? Is this fair that Job is suffering? And his friends say, well, it has to be fair because God runs the entire universe on fairness, so Job must have done something wrong. And so they just plead with Job with well-intended hearts that he would flee from evil, that he would run back to God. And Job's like, I didn't do anything wrong. And then his friends are like, oh, so you're accusing God of doing something wrong. They're all asking the question, like, isn't the universe supposed to run on a law of justice, a law of retribution? And in this case, it seems like it's not working. But instead, they should ask the question, where can wisdom be found and where can understanding be located? They need to understand that their understanding is the thing that's wrong. They need to know that their belief that God simply runs the universe on a strict code of retribution, that what man does, God then responds to, is instead to understand that by wisdom God made the universe. And if God is all wise, of course he understands how justice works, but he also understands how everything else in the universe is going to function, and that he is going to do what is right, because that is what justice is all about, is doing what is right. Not just doing the same thing over and over and over again of you did bad, so now you're punished. The characters in the book of Job up until this point have not begun to ask the question, maybe our understanding about God is off. Maybe the law of retribution is not how God operates the universe. Maybe we need to ask God for a little piece of his wisdom, so that we can understand him and the world that we live in. Last week we read James chapter 5, where it says that if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, because he gives to all men liberally and abradeth not. So far, no one in the book of Job has asked God for wisdom. They have only asked God for justice. And let that be a lesson to us, that we shouldn't just go to God and say, God, you're the judge of the universe, so therefore give us justice. Do what is right. Fix all the wrongs. Now, is it fair that, yes, God can and actually will in the future do that? Sure. But if all we do is look to God to be the enforcer of the universe, we are missing out on so much more of who God is and how the world functions. Instead, we should be coming to God and saying, like, I can't find wisdom anywhere else. I cannot gain understanding through anything else other than what you have given to me in your word and my time spent with you. I cannot function in your world properly without wisdom, so may I have some. And God says in James that he will give to those who ask him for wisdom like a liberal. Just pass it out, no charge. And in this case, aren't we all super happy about that? God has an infinite source of wisdom by which he created the universe that we lived in. And if we go to God and say, God, can I have a little bit of that? God would be like, more than happy. Here's a whole bunch more than you can handle. Let us not fall into the same mistakes that the characters of Job up until chapter 28 have fallen into oversimplifying God's universe, into oversimplifying God, into making the universe in our minds fit this box that somehow we would actually be able to control, because the universe is not ours to control. We cannot. We are incapable of. So instead of asking God strictly for a strict code of justice, let us go to God and ask him for wisdom. Let us ask him for understanding. It would be so much better. And Job was like so close. If he would say, where is God? I need to talk to him because I want to gain understanding from him, because I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on. Sometimes we're going to understand what is going on. Sometimes we won't. And even if we ask God for wisdom and understanding, he may not actually give us the entire understanding. But what we will know is that God is far more infinitely wise than we could ever be. He's definitely in control of the universe. He runs it the way he sees fit, and it is always right, even when it feels so wrong. Let us not put God into a box of simply being a source of karma. Do what's bad, you get bad stuff. Do what's good, you get good stuff. God is far greater than our sense of justice, and yet God will always bring about justice. So don't get upset about the fact that I'm telling you that, like, oh, justice is not important. It's important. You're going to have to wait till the end of the book of Job, okay? We'll talk about that again. The book of Job in chapter 28 gives us this change of mind, because I think many of us are right along the lines with Job and his friends saying, like, this isn't fair. When we face things in our life, we're like, this isn't fair. This isn't right. But then what we're saying by implication is God isn't right, because God is cosmically responsible and sovereign over everything that happens in our life. So when we say this isn't right, we're blaming God for doing something wrong. And I think we can all relate to Job's friends being like, well, let's make sense of the situation based on our simple understanding. Then something must be going wrong. We don't understand. Let that be the starting point, so that we ask for understanding and wisdom, not just, God, fix this. This won't make any sense. Turn to the God who runs the universe on wisdom and ask him for wisdom instead. This chapter 28, I'd encourage you to read and read and read and read. And as we go into the next several chapters, this is the beginning of the change of focus from justice to wisdom. That maybe God has enough wisdom to rightly run the universe, and that our understanding of justice and the universe is just too simplistic and too constrictive for the God who spoke the world into existence. For next week, I want us to read maybe a couple extra chapters. I know, I'm sorry. This week, some of these chapters were a little shorter, so hopefully it averages out. We are going to talk about Elihu, who talks all the way through chapter 37. So next week, you're only supposed to have read through 35. You read 36 and 37, we're going to talk all about what Elihu has to say. And we're all like, who's Elihu? We don't know. But he's there and he talks. And so we'll see what he says in response to Job and him declaring himself to be innocent, and therefore God must be wrong. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are all wise, and by your wisdom, you created this universe to function the way you intended it to. that even though the sin of man created the fall and created death and suffering, that you have created the universe to function on your wisdom. And we come to you today, as you told us in James, admitting that we do not understand everything that takes place in our life. We do not understand all of who you are and what you have been doing. We do not understand the pain in our life and in our world and in our communities. We do not understand why it is you would choose to do these things in our circumstances. Yet let us come to you and ask for wisdom, not just for you to fix the things that we would fix if we were you. We ask that you would give us a different perspective, but even a different one than Job's friends are giving to him, that we would understand that you are a God who is, yes, all in charge, all powerful, all knowing, all wise, but you also are all caring about us. That you did not create us to look at us like we were little bugs, but that you care for us enough to send your son to rescue us. That although he was perfectly righteous, you allowed suffering on him so that we could be rescued from our sin. And we pray that this perspective of your wisdom being the foundational law of the universe would change how we talk about you and about our lives, how we understand our lives, that we would understand you more, to come to know you more, to love you more, so that we can show you to those around us. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.